Hey, it's Andrew, the Director of Literary Arts. Here at Literary Arts, we rely on our community, people like you, for support. To help make this podcast and all our programming possible, give today, literary-arts.org/donate. Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project is provided by Cole Haan. Cole Haan's shoes, bags, and outerwear go with you while you work your way to extraordinary. More at colehaan.com. In this episode, we feature an event from the 2019 Portland Book Festival called Dangerous Love, Desire and Obsession. It features the poets Dianali Antigua, Jericho Brown, and Malcolm Tariq. The event was moderated by Erica Stevens. If you're not already a reader of poetry, stay tuned. This conversation may change your mind about what poetry is, what it can do, and who it is for. These poets are some of the most exciting at work today. Their writing engages with our most urgent issues and speak powerfully about an individual experience of race, class, power, sexual orientation, and gender identity, to name only a few of their themes. These poets write and read with urgency, passion, anger, and joy. And in conversation, they perform a vital function by approaching all of our most essential challenges from a perspective and with language fundamentally different from our news cycle and from our polarized political discourse. Through poetry, they are able to give us a new and surprising perspective on experiences and issues that we may otherwise feel are intractable. They are what we need to advance the conversation, and they remind me of that famous old Shelley quote, "Poets are the unacknowledged legislators of our world." And just a note, the episode contains adult themes and language that may not be suitable for all our listeners. Here's our moderator, Erica Stevens.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the panel on Dangerous Love. All right, directly to my right, Dianali Antigua is a Dominican-American poet and educator, born and raised in Massachusetts. Her debut collection, Ugly Music, was the winner of the Pamet River Prize. A graduate of the MFA program at NYU, she was awarded a Global Research Initiative Fellowship to Florence, Italy. She is the recipient of additional fellowships from Cantomundo, Community of Writers, and the Fine Arts Work Center Summer Program. Her poems can be found in Washington Square Review, Bennington Review, The Adroit Journal, and elsewhere. Her heart is in Brooklyn. Next is Malcolm Tariq, who is from Savannah, Georgia, and is the author of Extended Play, winner of the 2017 Gertrude Press Poetry Chapbook Contest. His debut poetry collection is Heed the Hollow, which is out just this week, right?
Yeah. Tuesday.
A graduate of Emory University, Tariq has a PhD in English from the University of Michigan, and he lives in New York. And Jericho Brown is the recipient of a Whiting Writers Award and fellowships from the John Simon Guggenheim Foundation, the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard University, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Brown's first book, Please, won the American Book Award. His second book, The New Testament, won the Ainsfield Wolf Book Award. His third book, The Tradition, is shortlisted for the National Book Award. Good luck, Jericho. His poems have appeared widely in publications such as The New York Times, The New Yorker, Time Magazine, the Pushcart Prize Anthology, and several others. He is an associate professor and the director of the Creative Writing Program at Emory University in Atlanta. And my name is Erica Stevens, and I am a senior editor at Coffeehouse Press.
Come through Coffee House, yeah, woo!
Thank you. So in the lead up to and after, you guys are gonna read first. Dianali, would you go first, please?
Absolutely. Okay. Variations on a theme. When my mother says I was born on a Wednesday like my new niece, I tell her the babies keep me on earth a little longer. I have to see their faces before I die. Then I tell her I must love or die. My baby can't be alone for more than a month. I need a bedfellow for the healing, bedfellow for each season above the ground. She laughs a little between tears, and I stay silent. It's not the end I want to say as I reach for her hand. I want to say, Mom, I'm in the bad order, the order of fire, then relief. I want to say, we don't get to pick what wrecks us. This little straw joins the other last straws. When the dozen eggs became none, or the crumbs fell like David's star to six different points in the room. And in the center, my mind thrashed in a crib made of bone. I want to say that a mother who was not my mother gave me a gift, a bracelet, a blue checkered gown, the rehearsed opera of my rights. I want to say, there are so many Wednesdays left to cry on. If I would have known then how many Wednesdays it would take to die, if I would have known all the Wednesdays I'd be given back. There is a song playing on the radio when I finally apologize to myself, and I can't make out the words, but it feels like forgiveness. Listen. I'm a stupid whore, and I'm sorry. I tried to hang myself, and I'm sorry. And if a piano could cure a life, let it be this one. I remember the two fish I colored in at the hospital looked like they were kissing my hand. And it felt soft, like my own lips mushed up against a mirror. And it was wet, as if the ocean had lived inside me and I'd just discovered the first wave.
That was great.
Thank you.
I'm going to try to follow that up. So the book begins with a poem called Power Bottom, and then it ends with a poem called Bottom Power, and so this is Bottom Power. Mm. Okay. Praise the bottom of USA, her blood and sweat in spite of death, deep gulf, spinning sea, stretch of moist marsh cultured into giving whose salt tears trail into the vast forever and unknown. Praise the plush bottom of USA, its tangle of fiber, a seat and sanctuary, the soft pulled from bowl by hard hands, afterlife living in the leftover lust of pride. Praise the hard bottom of USA. His cane erected willfully in your honor, sweet juice on the chin, the return each year bent on living whose seed lives on in rich rum-filled romance and rife abandon. Praise the soft bottom of USA. Her sugar still raw with rot of generations, her cotton gin gyration inflected into the games of children chattering rhymes on the street corner. Praise the sweet bottom of the South, our heft of holler ringing into present tense, the lift of fist festered into submission, the perverse sway of swamp housing the hush of history, the hollow of saltwater cyclone seeing and sealing truth, our tapestry of tabby toppling over as testimony. Praise the bottom of the black bottom, everything lost and lingering, our bone of brick still breaking, our emptiness, our backward lick of life, our distant desire, our queer quiet, our will and want, our silent sighs exalting, the cleft clit still singing in the labor of love. Praise the black bottom of the bottom, praise the blackest bottom, praise the bottom most black, praise the black, praise the black, praise the bottom, praise the bottom, praise the bottom.
Bullet points. I will not shoot myself in the head, and I will not shoot myself in the back, and I will not hang myself with a trash bag. And if I do, I promise you, I will not do it in a police car while handcuffed, or in the jail cell of a town I only know the name of, because I have to drive through it to get home. Yes, I may be at risk, but I promise you, I trust the maggots who live beneath the floorboards of my house to do what they must to any carcass more than I trust an officer of the law of the land to shut my eyes like a man of God might, or to cover me with a sheet so clean my mother could have used it to tuck me in. When I kill me, I will do it the same way most Americans do. I promise you, cigarette smoke, or a piece of meat on which I choke, or so broke I freeze in one of these winters we keep calling worst. I promise if you hear of me dead anywhere near a cop, then that cop killed me. He took me from us and left my body, which is, no matter what we've been taught, greater than the settlement a city can pay a mother to stop crying, and more beautiful than the new bullet fished from the folds of my brain.
Well, I don't know how we're going to follow that, but we're going to try. In the lead up to and after the 2016 election, discussions about and consciousness of trauma came into white Americans every day in a way that seemed like a revelation to many of them, but was not at all new for people of color in the United States. Has your work changed or shifted post-2016? Has this political and social moment opened some kind of door, or is it pretty much the same as it ever was? Malcolm, you're smiling.
I am. I'm still thinking, though.
Theonelli?
I guess to answer that question, I would start off by saying that 2016 was a year of a lot of transitions for me and changes. You know, I was in my second year of my MFA at the time, so I think my voice was just starting to develop as a poet and starting to feel like my own. And in the wake of the election, I can say that, you know, my poetry hasn't changed. And it's not to say that I haven't been affected by the election, but it's to say that it's not my responsibility to change my poetry in order to educate others about what's going on in the country. I think it's up to each individual to do that. And my poetry, I think, lives in a different world, a world of individual trauma. And it's not, I mean, I'm still trying to write about that trauma. Mm-hmm. I'm not ready to start writing about this nation's trauma as a whole.
Yeah.
Though I think my own personal trauma does line up with some of what is going on in the country, obviously. But I feel I owe myself the responsibility to work out my own first. You know, mm-hmm. I come first.
Excellent. Anybody else have any thoughts? Jericho? Malcolm?
I think I write poems that are I think most of my art is informed by other art. Obviously, it's also informed by really good conversations that I have with friends, informed by memories that I have from my own childhood as well as whatever I ate yesterday, you know? So I think, of course, you know, we all have the same social media where, you know, there are only so many news channels we could be watching. So, yeah, I'm sure something of that goes into something of any particular time, including that time, mm-hmm. goes into my writing. I also think, though, that the poet's response is often, at least my response as a poet, and I think I might have this in common with many other poets, is to subvert. You sort of automatically want to rebel, want to subvert, want to use the thing given you and turn it into something else. So for me, I was very consciously hoping and trying not to write about the election. I also, like so many people in this country, felt and still do feel sort of hurt by the politics of surprise. I'm not really interested in hearing about people's surprise. I don't believe them. I don't know how many days in a row you got to be surprised by the same things. So I didn't want to feed into that by writing poems that that would address it as if that were okay. I also was quite offended, I have to say, by poets and artists who were participating, no matter their race, but who were participating in this politics of surprise around that time. It was as if, I don't know, it felt like, so we all had been reading Allen Ginsberg, and we all had been reading Audre Lorde, and we all had been reading Adrienne Rich, but I was the only one who believed them. Like, y'all thought they was playing? Y'all thought that was a game? That was a game. That was a joke, you know? Yeah. So that really bothered me, you know? Because these people, for me, I think of these people, you know, as idols, as ancestors. And part of what I'm doing when I make my work is that one of the things that my work probably does is begin to further their work. So it does feel very strange for people to respond with surprise. I do think I should say this, that I was probably much more moved by the fact of what we call the Me Too movement emotionally. And I do think that many of the poems from my book that have to do with rape and sexual violence and sexual coercion happened because I did not see other men who I know, I mean, everyone actually in this room, we know boys who are now men who had their first experiences sexually with grown women when they were 10 and 11 and 12 years old. And grown men. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
And so that kind of a thing was something that I felt like it was probably, as far as I know, the only time that I've been driven to write something out of a feeling of pure responsibility. I felt like if I did not do that, it wouldn't be done by a man in the same in the same way in that moment. And I felt that it was a shame not to see that happen. I just don't like pretending. I don't like the way we pretend stuff, you know?
Right, right.
Like, people try to act like they don't know what women go through. I mean, I wouldn't know because I'm not a woman, but I ain't crazy either. Like, people, like, y'all know, it's so strange. Like, people in this country really think that black people are getting together in basements making these narratives up. I wish. I wish black people were the way people really think black people are some kind of a they. Do you know what I mean? That are like we get together and we got this plan and we're gonna take over. We're gonna take over TNT. We're gonna take over your television. Oh no! Look at all these black people on TV. Like, that's what we're doing. Like, we getting together for that, to take over your TV. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
I mean, it's really. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, people really believe that there's sort of a conspiracy. There's this conspiracy among black people to do these kinds of things. And you know, I wish there were. But maybe they just don't invite me to the meetings.
I would find that hard.
Because I would
tell.
I'd be like, we're doing it, y'all.
When you said that, I was thinking about my life. And I was in Ann Arbor from 2013 to 2016. And then I moved back to Atlanta that summer. And so when I was in Ann Arbor, that was when there was a lot of protests and marches around police brutality and those cases that were coming up, sorry. And so there were a lot of marches. I was teaching and in schools. I was also teaching about subjects similar to that and encouraging my students to do things. But I think when the election happened, I realized, and even before that, like what I was able to do mentally, like what I could contribute. And I realized that I couldn't be the one in the streets doing the work all the time, that my job was to be in the classroom writing when I could, but to be like in the background providing that support, because that's just as important as being active and being the spokesperson. But when the election happened, I remember I wrote this poem, or I was trying to write this poem. Richard Wright, I was in his archives, and I think it was an essay or a poem, and the title of it was, "Mr. President, I think it's time we eat the Negroes." And I forget what it was about, but I was gonna like riff on something about that, but then it just got boring. Like I forgot about it until now because that was, I think it was just a cool idea, but it wasn't really challenging me to think any differently than what I already had. So I don't think the election changed my art as much as it changed my knowing what I could do.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Kind of feeds into my next question. So the poet Don Lundy Martin recently said, "Poems are the place where you try to solve a problem that's unsolvable by being radically honest." So when it comes to things like love, sex, trauma, desire, even politics and what you can do about politics, does that hold true? Like, is radical honesty a precondition?
Yes.
Yeah?
You know, it's stylized language. There's that. But then there's what you're going to do with it and what it says through its stylization, not just through, you know, a poem. In a poem, you can fall out of a sky and land on a deer and ride across the Atlantic Ocean. You can do that in a poem, but you better not try that in real life, you know? But something about that should lead us to some feeling, something about the fact of riding across the Atlantic Ocean on a deer should lead us to some truth that we did not have before, it seems to me. And that truth doesn't necessarily have to be one that we can nail down in some sort of easy sentence or phrase. It might be an ephemeral or an emotional truth. And I think that's what we're doing. I mean, I think that's, it seems to me our job. I mean, I would like to believe that was the job of an adult, like you sort of do that because you're an adult, but you know, that you tell the truth, you know, about your life, and that you're not afraid of hearing the truth. But we don't actually, being an adult doesn't mean that for us. So we have to have poets.
Absolutely.
I kind of wanted to piggyback on what you were talking about as far as emotional truth. I mean, I do believe in radical honesty for myself and for my poetry, but there are some poems in my collection that, although they were created from experiences or language that was maybe a central traumatic situation in my life, I have been able to, I guess, go to the emotional truth of that specific experience rather than, you know, tell the exact truth, if that makes sense, but more so just for the craft of the poem, not because I'm trying to conceal anything. I am brutally honest in my poetry, and I'm not ashamed of that at all. You know, I'm not ashamed to write poems about mental illness or about sexual abuse. I think that it's something that I personally needed to write about and as part of my healing process and to be radically honest about those. But sometimes for the craft of the poem, I've changed certain things, but that's not to say that it's necessarily dishonest. It still holds true to the experience.
I think there are many different truths, like there's no one truth. And as a person who writes to find an answer, that doesn't always happen, but truth will happen in the process. And so I have to separate truth from like getting to that one answer that I want, and then sometimes realizing there's no answer. And so the process, I think, of writing is I'll start one place and then I'll end up another place because something has been made known to me that I didn't know before. Whether that be about myself or about the world or just about what I'm doing in that moment. It also makes me think a lot about when I was growing up and I would hear these stories and I would think that's not true. But it's told so much that it becomes true. And then sometimes writing is undoing that story you were told or that I was told. And trying to figure out what else was happening in this room where nobody else wants to say what actually happened to them.
It's really interesting. I'm going to shift tack a little bit, but not totally. All of you use form in really interesting and perhaps unexpected ways in your work. And at least one of you here invented a form. So my question is, what does form enable you to do? Are there certain subjects, like the ones that are the topic of this panel, that are easier to address within certain parameters? So, Jericho, why the duplex? Why invent form? Yeah.
I'll say this about form in general. For me as a poet, I'm really interested in formal. I've always been obsessed with, since I was a kid, pretty obsessed with formal work, just sort of amazed by the fact. I'll never forget when I figured out that people were translating sonnets from a language that was not English into English, and it would still rhyme. I remember like figuring out that had happened and rolling on the floor. See, like I couldn't get it together. So I think what formal work allows for me, and in a way also allows for the reader, is an interaction with a kind of built-in surprise, because I'm working with a repeated line, or a repeated line is so often a repurposed line, or when you're working with rhyme. When you're doing formal work, every time you get to the point where you're being true to the form, you have to do things that, you have to make use of language that you may not have expected to use, right? So in order to, let's say, you know, mellow rhymes with yellow, but when you get to the word yellow, because it rhymes with mellow, when you get to that word, that then could very well change what you thought you were writing about. Once something is yellow, then your mind changes, your the vision of it changes. Do y'all see what I mean? And so therefore, it actually, people have this fear of form as writers. Sometimes people feel, or beginning writers feel, that form is going to somehow box them in and not allow them to do things. But for me, it makes me more free because I have no idea where I'm gonna go. So I get to say things I didn't expect to say. Which I think is part of how you get at what we were talking about earlier as it relates to being honest and telling the truth. You sort of, if you can follow the music of language in an unconscious way, then you end up saying things you didn't expect to say. And when you say things you didn't expect to say, you can say to yourself as a writer, who thought that? Do I think that? Oh, I don't think that. Do you understand what I mean? I think that's writing. I think that's what it is, you know. So I invented a form called the duplex, which is at once a huzzle, a sonnet, and a blues poem. One of the reasons that happened is I'm always getting sort of called to the mat about identity. I think everybody probably feels this way. We're always told we have competing identities. Isn't that crazy? Competing identities, and you got one body. Good luck. I actually don't feel like I have competing identities. I feel whole. I don't feel like I'm, you know, 16% black and 40% Southern and 6% queer. I don't, you know, I feel like I'm 100% poet, you know, a real black, gay, Southern poet. Do you follow what I mean? I feel that real whole. And so I wanted to create a body that could carry these forms from these different times and these different places. And I wanted that body to be all those things at one time, but to also be its own thing. And I wanted something that no matter what was put into that form, it would sound a bit like casting a spell. So that's part of why I invented it. I had written a bunch of sonnets that I imagined were going to be in a book, and after a while,
would you read us one?
Yeah, sure.
Duplex.
I begin with love, hoping to end there. I don't want to leave a messy corpse. I don't want to leave a messy corpse full of medicines that turn in the sun. Some of my medicines turn in the sun. Some of us don't need hell to be good. Those who need most need hell to be good. What are the symptoms of your sickness? Here is one symptom of my sickness. Men who love me are men who miss me. Men who leave me are men who miss me. In the dream where I am an island, in the dream where I am an island, I grow green with hope. I'd like to end there.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I was one of those people who I said that I didn't write formal poetry. And then I had a friend recently who told me that I was a formal poet, and I was like, what are you talking about? And then he pointed to all these poems in the book. I didn't even realize that that was happening. But I think that form, with writing this project, it really helped me understand what I was doing. It was just a lot of different things all together, and I just didn't know. And so I wrote a bop to just organize the form of a bop. Is there's a question, there's three parts to it, and a refrain. So you ask a question, and by the end of it, you either say what the answer is, or you say why you couldn't answer the question. And so that helped me understand what I was doing with the rest of the poetry. But I think that form also, along with that, like, leads me to different places that I didn't know where I would go, kind of like what you were saying, Jericho. Mm-hmm. And it teaches me things about myself, but it's also just really fun to say, this is what I can do and this is what I can't do. Mm-hmm. And it becomes an exercise that's just enjoyable. Like, it's just joy for me. Mm-hmm. And as I was writing these very difficult subjects, I was like smiling because I was doing this great thing that I didn't think I could do. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I'm talking about like violence and sex. Mm-hmm. And those two things should not go together. Like, joy, you shouldn't be like joyous when you're like writing about this stuff, but just the process of saying I can do this and I didn't know I was doing it, or I didn't think I could, and this is all the things that I learned. That's what form has done for me, at least the past few years.
Cool. Yeah. It is all over your book, form.
Yes. Yeah, I didn't, you know.
Dean Elliott, your book is structured as a form.
Yes.
You know, you've got it structured as like a perfect song, verse, chorus, bridge, chorus, outro.
Yes. I mean, this book was definitely heavily influenced by music. And I really wanted the reader to kind of ride the frequency of a song from beginning to end. You know, when you first hear those first chords or piano keys until the very end, where, you know, there's just a lot of kind of drama and then maybe like a little bit of softness as well. And then in the middle is kind of that shift. And that my bridge, which is that shift, takes my poetry from kind of the more personal poems that I was writing to poems that were a bit outside of the speaker, poems that dealt with my culture and language and history, especially poems that were about the dictatorship in the Dominican Republic under Trujillo. So I have poems that relate to that, as well as poems about immigration and my own immigration story, which is very different from, let's say, a, you know, traditional immigration story. So I really wanted that section to kind of bring the reader elsewhere, but then still be connected to what the other poems were in the book as well. So not too much of a shift, but still enough so that it's recognizable. And may I read one of those poems?
Actually? Yes, please.
I actually will read the poem about immigration. Immigration story. I was 10 years old when I read about the boy whose mother drowned in the ocean. It was in the Scholastic News, the aluminum boat leaving Cuba, the shipwreck, the 10 more dead with her, the boy floating on an inner tube until rescued by fishermen. His face was on the front page of the magazine, and I remember wanting to kiss his paper cheek. His name is Elian, and today he turns 23. My mother shows me a picture of his mother, and she is beautiful in the way all mothers were in the 90s, all bangs, high-waisted jersey shorts. and I don't know what it is to lose a mother yet. I won't see her scoop water from a sinking boat. My mother came here on a plane, and I thank a god. A different island, a different year, a baby girl, not me, in her arms. Eliane went back to Cuba, and I have never visited the island I'm from, and I feel like a bitch, because all I did was read a story and then retell it on the page.
So now I'm going to ask about joy. Aria D. Matthews tweeted, "The hardest poem to write is one of joy. I don't know why. Maybe because we sense it in our bodies as loss. Maybe because as soon as joy comes, something has to replace it. Maybe because we privilege the thieves of joy above joy itself." So my question is joy difficult? Is it more vulnerable to write joy? Do you have difficulty writing joy?
It's quite exhilarating and also quite difficult to write a poem. So I think, when I'm making poems, I'm not really thinking, oh, I have 6 joyful ones and 7, what is that, melancholy ones? You know what I mean? Like, I'm just trying to make poems happen, and I'm really excited about whatever I get. I will say that, part of my preoccupation with the love poem has to do with the fact that, I love Gwendolyn Brooks's love poems. I love Lucille Clifton's love poems. There are these the love poems of Nikki Giovanni. I get excited about those poems partially because those poems are often alongside a good deal of poems that people would think of as protest poems. Do you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I like thinking about the fact that Phyllis Wheatley married somebody she was in love with. I love thinking about that. Isn't that nice? See, I gave that to you. Isn't that nice? Isn't that nice?
It is. It's lovely.
So think part of that has to do with the fact that, you know, things are bad. They will be. But people will still fall in love anyway. I'm really worn out by that, you know, that people fall in love. It's real, have y'all seen the news? Who has the time? You know what I mean? I think what I'm interested in is the way I see poet as identity is that I see everything and I'm telling as much as I can through stylized language. I'm telling as much of the truth as I can about everything I see. But then that, it would mean I was lying if I was only telling you the terrible things. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I don't know if it sells me more books or less books by saying so, but there aren't only terrible things. It just aren't. There aren't only terrible things. I think part of the reason why we don't like saying that too often is because it gives people get afraid that folk will hear that and, you know, sort of get off of their responsibility seat. Oh, there aren't already terrible things, so I can just let these kids stay in their cages. Do you understand what I'm saying? It doesn't work like that, actually. But there aren't always terrible things.
I think, too, joy is very nuanced as well. I'm thinking about one of my recent poems that I wrote, and the line says, "Sometimes the things we love most were shown to us by the people who caused the most pain." Mm-hmm. And this poem that I wrote, it's titled Connections. It's not in the collection, but it did come out earlier this year in Cordella magazine, if you want to read the whole thing. But this poem talks about my first experience seeing the New York skyline as a 4-year-old and how much joy that brought me. It was just amazing seeing how tall the buildings were and just kind of just being enamored by everything, the smells and the people. I was in love with that city even before I had ever lived there. But the kind of tragic thing about this story is that I fell in love with New York while sitting on the shoulders of my soon-to-be abuser. And I mean, even saying that, my heart sinks a little bit. But, you know, I sometimes don't know what to do with joy because it's often just so entangled with trauma. Or, you know, trauma is entangled with joy. I mean, when I think about my abuser, I mean, there were times where he did make me laugh and he did bring me some joy. But that doesn't change the fact that he also brought upon some of the most traumatic things that I could ever possibly think about. But I agree with what Jericho was saying, that it's not all bad. I mean, there are things now that bring me really great joy. I mean, even seeing New York again, I don't immediately think of my abuser. I mean, I think about my MFA experience. I think about all of the coffee shops that line the streets and all of the wonderful people that New York has brought to me. I mean, like, I met Jericho at a reading at Housing Works in New York, and we went out to a Cuban restaurant and ate with some Cave Canem poets. I mean, how can I say that wasn't a joyous experience? And I mean, I'm just grateful for those small moments, even if they're sparing, of joy. And I'm trying more to incorporate that into my poetry. I think Ada Limone is a wonderful example of poetry that talks about joy. And she herself was a workshop leader of mine. And she says that, you know, writing a poem about joy doesn't mean that it has to be just happy. And joy is something in spite of, or despite pain, that we've experienced such trauma and still we can celebrate small things. So I'm trying to find more moments in poetry to incorporate that myself.
That's wonderful. I have one more question and then we're gonna open the floor to some questions. We'll have time for just a couple. So I'm gonna end with a question actually about anger. So for example, in all of your books, there are these moments of anger, but in the tradition, your book, Jericho, there are these gorgeously, stunningly incandescent moments of anger that sort of erupt and then fade a little bit. There's plenty of love and plenty else, but I'm wondering about the challenge of writing a book that's emotionally honest and complex and, you know, all sorts of different things. And how do you do that? Do you go to the gym a lot? Do you take a lot of naps? Do you drink a lot of coffee? How does it happen?
So interesting. People are, so thank you. I appreciate this question. I also really, I'm so grateful that people are so, people are so sincerely concerned about me in ways that I don't know to be concerned about myself. And I'm grateful that this book happened, that I finished it, because I really thought my book was gonna kill me. In particular, I mean, I've never written a book before where so many people, after reading the book, you know, this is my third book, so many people after reading this book are like, are you okay? How'd you do that? And I'm like, I was just writing my poems, you know. I mean, y'all can tell me if y'all feel this way or not. I feel like I'm always sitting around with my rage and with my fear. And I feel like the only reason my rage and my fears don't lead me to doing particularly violent things has to do with the fact that I can be honest with myself about the fact that they're there and I can talk to them. They're not gonna go away. My rage, you know, I'm Black. It's not going away. It's not. So I have to have a relationship with it. And I have to tell it, you know, if you talk to your fears don't go away. Your fears came from somewhere. They came from a place where they were actually necessary at a time. Do y'all know what I mean? And then there comes a point in your life when you don't need them no more, but you still use them. And they're often holding us back. Your rage, your fear can hold you back from something that you love or that you really desire. You just have to, you have to literally talk to that stuff and be like, I know that I needed you before, and I know you were of use to me, and I really appreciate you, but I'm going to do this one without you. And when I'm writing my poems, it's really me having that conversation with my rage, and I let my rage say what it has to say, and I say what I have to say back to it, which is why all the poems aren't just rageful, but also why all the poems don't play at some sort of false joy, mm-hmm. you know?
I think that sometimes the anger, like I have to write to get the anger out. Like I have to write to live. That I realized when I was, I don't know how old I was, this was like 2015, and I was living in Ann Arbor, which is a very, has anyone ever been to Ann Arbor or lived there? Did you survive? You survived. I didn't think I was going to survive. And so I had to, before this book came out, I think 2 years ago, I had a chapbook that came out, and I sometimes forget that I wrote another thing because I just had to write all of this anger out of me, and then it was done. And some people bought it, but then I just moved on after that. It was just a way for me to live, which I heard people say that before, but I didn't quite understand it. In a way that I did after living in Ann Arbor for 3 years. And I should say Ann Arbor is difficult for Black queer people, specifically single Black queer people who are in their 20s and in grad school. and from the South.
Okay.
I realized that I'm generally a calm person, but I think my anger manifested itself in different ways. Like even one of my advisors noticed, which I didn't think, like I left Ann Arbor and went back a year later and he's like, oh yeah, you were really ready to leave. I didn't even notice that it was that like urgent for me, but writing helped me through that last year. Whereas with this book, I don't think there was a lot of anger. It was just a lot of, not even my trauma per se, or maybe it was, but it wasn't because I had written it out mostly. It's just a lot of violence in the book. But that's my relationship with writing my anger. And it's also just how I live with it. So, sometimes when I go back to Ann Arbor, me and Ann Arbor are cool now, just because I don't live there. But I still get like tense when I'm there at times.
Yeah.
But because I've written about it, and a big part of writing that chapbook was sharing it with my friends. So I had like this art gallery. In the book, there's a poem where I talk about the twerk room, which was in my house in Ann Arbor. And it was just this empty room where we had parties. But the twerk room was empty. It was supposed to be a kitchen or something, I don't know. I made it into an art gallery with the poems and some photos I took on Snapchat. And my friends came over, and I remember writing them an email saying, these are difficult poems, we're not gonna cry. This is a moment of joy that I get to share this with you. Mm. Bring wine. And it was a really nice event.
That sounds beautiful, actually. I feel like in my book, I wouldn't necessarily call it rage. It's like, it's a lot of sadness with, with an underlying anger to it in some ways. And there obviously are a lot of poems about violence towards the body, especially the female body. And I feel like the only way that I've been able to cope with writing about this book, or writing of this book, has been therapy. I mean, it's been a saving grace to me. I started therapy 7 years ago, and I'd never turn back. And I think writing this book has also been extremely therapeutic for me. And I think that writing truly did save me. And I know that sounds really corny, but I started writing in a journal when I was 9, and that was where I first started writing about these traumatic experiences. And I think maybe in those journals there was a bit of rage and anger. But I mean, decades have passed since you know, those rageful entries, and now I am here as an adult, kind of recollecting in tranquility these kind of really powerful feelings. And it's kind of a bit of a distance that's been created that's allowed me to then come back and write about them in a calmer way.
Nice. Well,
it's so nice to see Wordsworth quoted at a panel. You don't see much of that anymore. Thank you so much, Dianella. That just gave me so much. Thank you. Isn't that nice? That was really, oh, Wordsworth coming up. What's up, man? He was a mess.
All right. I think we've got time for like 1.5 questions. So let's have questions and make sure they're questions, please. So the question is about poetic sensibilities. What translates into a poem? What doesn't? How do you do that?
I mean, I think you can write a poem about anything. And I think I often do write poems about anything. And I think that, I mean, I don't try to police my own experiences and say, like, this sounds poetic and this doesn't. I mean, I have poems about, you know, eating a bag of dill pickle chips and falling asleep. Like, it doesn't really matter what it's about. I find a way to connect it to something that's greater. But I feel like the mundane always plays a really important role in my poetry. Mm-hmm. And I accept that willingly. And I don't feel like I need to go to some like special place in my poetry in order to get something out. I think that, you know, again, really small experiences, like one of my poems, it starts with, as I watch a man steal fruit on the corner of Myrtle Ave and Broadway. I saw a man steal fruit on the corner of Myrtle Ave and Broadway, and I didn't think it was important at the moment, but it ended up being the first lines of my poem about my sexual abuse. And I mean, that just came out of literally nowhere. Mm-hmm. So everything is a poem. I think you can turn everything into a poem.
The sensibility is interesting to think about. For me, it really just has to do with the fact that I don't start with an about. So the subjects themselves arise from the sounds of the language that I'm using. So I'm much more interested. I never actually think to write a poem about anything. Never. And if I were to, I'm pretty sure that is one way to read a very bad Jericho Brown poem. So I don't sit down trying to write a poem about blank. I think you get the subjects you get. Because if I were to sit down and write a poem about blank, I would fill in that blank with some real easy, nice, good times. You know, I mean, all my poems would just be like, you fine, you so fine, oh my God. Jesus Christ, you are fine. Look at you, look at how you, oh my God. So usually what I'll have is a line that I'm attracted to, most often because of its music, something about its rhythm, its literal meter, or its alliteration, something about its sound. And I move forward from that sound. And I don't care what it's about. I figure out what it's about once I have so many sounds on the page that I am at the point where I'm wondering what I have been saying. So for me, just thinking in terms of actual sensibility, that's what it is. It's not knowing what the subjects are and letting them rise from my unconscious, hopefully rise from my unconscious.
I'll say that sometimes the difficult thing for me is figuring out how much of myself is in the poem and how much is not, and how much should be and how much I should take out. Not this past summer, 2018 at the Kaveh Kanem retreat, I had a one-on-one with Krista Bonnie about actually the title poem in this book that wasn't in this book originally. It's a long story. And it was like therapy, where I thought I was writing this poem about this thing, and then he drew this map, and he was like, no, you're writing about your dead uncle, which it made sense, but it didn't make sense to me. But I like the process of therapy with Chris Abani a lot. But I also don't think that I need to be in the poem all the time, especially if it's not about me. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the best poems or the best experiences with the poem is taking things that don't make sense and putting them together and figuring out why they don't make sense, but they definitely do make sense, which is why Chris Abani told me that poem was about my dead uncle. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll say that.
So unfortunately we're out of time, but thank you so much for coming.
That was a conversation among poets Dianelli Antigua, Jericho Brown, and Malcolm Tariq from the Portland Book Festival in 2019. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project is provided by Cole Haan, on a mission to fuel your big ideas. More at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.